You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 100 by Rudolf Steiner, a book entitled True Knowledge of the Christ, composed of two cycles. I'm reading the first cycle, 14 lectures, entitled Theosophy and Rosicrucianism at the moment, and I am now on the last lecture, Lecture 14, translated by Anna Moise. Given in Kassel on the 29th of June, 1907. Yesterday I spoke of the Rosicrucian initiation, as it is called, up to the third stage, quote, learning the occult script, close quote. We also came to know the Rosicrucian way of study, the gaining of insight in images, and then finding one's way into the occult script, the signs that have been taken from the natural world. We must now move on to the fourth stage, which is called, quote, preparing the philosopher's stone, close quote. Please leave aside anything you may read about this in old books, and understand that it is only at the present time that one can say something about what Rosicrucians actually meant by preparing the philosopher's stone. Certain rules had been given for getting up into the higher worlds, since the well-known founder of Rosicrucianism had established it in 1459. You have to understand that this stream has always been treated with the greatest care and always kept secret. It was somewhere toward the end of the 18th century and at the beginning of the 19th century that there was a kind of betrayal and some of the Rosicrucian secrets came to be publicly known. Various publications appeared then, and it was evident from them that those concerned had heard something but did not understand it. They did at least hear proper words, picking up something, also concerning the Philosopher's Stone. Some reports even appeared in the title Reich Anzeiger paper, at the time about a society which had set itself the task of preparing the Philosopher's Stone. And one item was such that only those who knew what it was all about were able to understand. It said, quote, yes, the philosopher's stone does exist. Most people actually know it. Most have even held it in their hand. It is not that difficult to find, though most people do not know this, close quote. The idea behind this concept of the philosopher's stone was that it would gradually teach one to know the immortal part of man, the part that is not subject to death, and would guide one to the higher worlds. When human beings come to realize that this immortal part cannot be subject to death and are in possession of the philosopher's stone, this means that they attain to eternal life, overcoming death. The interpretation that was put on this was that one would never die. The real meaning was, however, that this allows human beings to get to know the world in which they will live after death. Apart from this, the Philosopher's Stone was also considered to be an elixir of life. All this made the Philosopher's Stone something to be greatly desired. Those who knew what it was about had to consider these words to be true in a strange way, for they are true, but those who did not know the secret could make little of them. Let me now show you briefly what is meant by them. To understand this, you'll have to follow me in a very simple natural scientific fact. You have to know the nature of the relationship between human beings and the plant world. The facts are that everything which breathes the way humans do could never exist were it not for the plants. You need to familiarize yourselves with the process that occurs between you and the plants. You inhale the air. You need the oxygen from it. You'd never be able to live without oxygen. When you take in the air and use the oxygen in your organism, you exhale carbon dioxide, a compound of carbon and oxygen. So you have to say to yourself, quote, human beings are all the time taking in oxygen to maintain life and exhaling carbon dioxide. They are, therefore, all the time producing a poison which would kill them. So you are all the time filling the world around you with poison. Close quote. What does the plant do? It is, in a way, doing the exact opposite. It takes in carbon dioxide, retains the carbon, and releases the oxygen, which is of no use to it. So you are giving the plant what it needs, and the plant gives back the oxygen in return. This process of carbon dioxide breathing and release of oxygen far exceeds the plant's uptake of oxygen. What does the plant do with the carbon it retains? It uses it to some degree to build up its body. You are, as it were, giving the plant occasion to build up its body in the way that is appropriate for it. And you will have the same substance thousands of years later when you dig up the plant as anthracite. The plant gives you oxygen. You take this in. You give it the carbon dioxide. It keeps the carbon, building its body with it, and gives the oxygen back to you. It is a wonderful interaction which takes place there. This is how it is today. Humanity is, however, evolving, and in future the human body will be such that it will have the organ in itself which changes carbon dioxide into oxygen and will retain the carbon itself. Here I am pointing to a future condition of man in a different way than I did yesterday when speaking of Rosicrucian training. In future, human beings will have a desire-free body of a higher order than that of the plant, which is at a lower level. They will be able to build a body for themselves that will be plant-like at a higher level. The organ which today is the human heart will then be an apparatus that will do what the plant is doing today. Today, plant and human being belong together. Neither could live without the other. If there were no plants, all oxygen-breathing life forms would have to die out in a short time, for the plants give us our oxygen. We cannot think the human being without the plant. But in future, the organ, into which the heart will develop, will do in us what the plant is now doing outside us. It will then be a voluntary muscle. We spread our conscious mind out over the plants. We grow together with the plant world, so that the function the plant has outside today will later be inside us. We will then also retain the carbon which we give off today, using it to build our own body. We shall be plant-like at a higher level of conscious awareness. In occultism, all this has, from time immemorial, been given the form of a wonderful legend, for truths have, for centuries, been preserved in images and legends. Here it is the golden legend, and the things I have told you today were taught to students of occultism in images, more or less like this. When Seth, the son whom God had given to Adam and Eve in place of their murdered son Abel, entered into paradise on one occasion, he found the two trees, the tree of knowledge and the tree of life, intertwined. They wound their branches around one another. At the behest of the angel who was with him, Seth took three seeds from this tree. He kept them safe, and when Adam died, he put the three seeds into his mouth. A tree then grew from Adam's grave. for those who knew how to look. This tree showed writing in letters of fire, the words Eha Asher Eha. I am the one who was, who is, and who will be. Seth then took wood of that tree growing from Adam's grave and made various things of it, including the staff which was Moses' magic rod. And it was reproduced further. The portal to the Temple of Solomon was made of it. And later, when it had gone through various other fates, the cross on which the Redeemer did hang. Thus the legend brings together the wood of the cross on Golgotha and the tree which grew on Adam's grave from seeds taken from the tree in paradise. The secret at which I hinted today is also hidden in this legend. It was meant to tell us that in times immemorial, the human race was such that it had not yet come down to being flesh filled with desire, but was chaste and pure, like the plant holding up its calyx to the sun. Then came the fall, and humanity's flesh was filled with desire. Yet human beings shall have again everything that was theirs, when they were in a state of innocence, if they have taken the path of insight and created the desire-free body, the body as it has once been, before man entered into knowledge. Remember where the capital I comes from. Man no longer has the body of old, because he has become a lung breather and is able to develop red blood. The present form of human beings is therefore connected with breathing and blood circulation, and because of this, they have been able to become the bearers of insight, which they are today. Put yourself into the present-day body. There you can get a picture of the way the oxygen flows in, how it stirs up the red blood, how the red blood flows through the whole body like in a branching tree, how the blue blood then flows back full of carbon dioxide. You have two trees in you, the red blood tree and the blue one. Without the two, human beings could not be bearers of an I. This is why the red blood has to be taken up. It is the way in which our present-day insight is called forth. But death was also part of this, where you are changing the red blood into blue blood, full of carbon dioxide. And so the occult teacher in the Old Testament said, quote, "Look at yourself. You have the red blood tree in you. If you had not been given this tree, you would never have been a human being rich in insight. You have eaten of the tree of knowledge. But this did at the same time take away your ability to give life to yourself out of yourself." Close quote. The tree of life had turned into a tree that killed. This is why the blue blood tree in us is the tree of death. That is the present condition. The initiate's soul does, however, have a future condition before it, when human beings will have plant nature in them, when the blue blood will be changed back into red blood through the heart apparatus. They will then have changed the tree of death into a tree of life. Human beings will then have become immortal. They will be once again at a higher level, what they have once been at a lower one. They will then have the apparatus in themselves, which today exists in the plant. Paradise thus represented an end stage for man. And Seth's mission was understood to be that he saw what comes at the end of time, when the two principles will be in balance in man himself. The tree of life and the tree of knowledge thus intertwine in paradise. They can only find one another in the human being, when the human being has recourse to the plant. But how do human beings gain the ability to have the two trees intertwined in them? By developing the three higher levels of human nature in themselves. We have got to know the human being made up of physical body, ether body, astral body, and eye, and we have seen how by working on the astral body, the eye achieves the first of the higher constituent principles, by working on the ether body, the second one, and how it works on the physical body to gain the third. The future human being will therefore have seven constituent principles, the higher ones being spirit self, life spirit, and spiritual human being. When man has thus transformed his lower nature, he will have the tree of knowledge and the tree of life in himself. From the beginning of his evolution, man was therefore given the preconditions for the three higher constituent principles as a potential in his eye. Seth took the seeds, and Adam, the first human being endowed with the eye nature, let those three seeds grow into a tree. In this tree, there was the principle that goes through all your incarnations. At the first incarnation, your eye was at a very low level. It then rose to higher and higher levels as incarnation followed incarnation. The symbol for the eternal in us was growing there. And it will reach its highest level of perfection by the end of the earth stage of evolution. Human beings will, however, only be able to attain to it if they connect with all the most sublime which they have come upon on the path of the Spirit. Everything that has guided humanity on that upward path, the rod of Moses, the temple of Solomon, and finally the cross on Golgotha, all this helps human beings to give full expression to the three higher principles. And it was the cross on Golgotha which pointed the way to man's greatest perfection. To begin with, it had been put in Adam's mouth as the seed from which the tree then grew. One could not put it in any better way than has been done here, and was made from the wood which Seth had obtained in this way. This shows the road followed by humanity going through the ages, humanity's road through time. Today the plant is able to do the things which human beings must gain in future, transforming their essential nature, the ability to use their own powers to produce their own carbon. At a future time, humanity will be able to master this alchemy of the plant. In alchemy, the process I have just been describing consists in giving the Rosicrucian pupil certain directions as to how to regulate his breathing. This, too, can only be understood according to the principle that, quote, a steady drip hollows the stone, close quote. But the Rosicrucian pupil would work away at it, as a drop, being small, tiny, will need a long time to hollow the stone. So is progress made in human bodies with this process of regulating one's breathing. The directions which the pupil has to follow are such that they put him in the way of making preparations today for his eye to gain the ability to develop future bodies in a different way. It does mean, however, that the things which will be your physical surroundings at a later time will be there for you even now in the spiritual world. The advice given to Rosicrucians is to prepare for one's future condition in a slow process, gaining the ability to behold this condition even now in the higher worlds. So the Rosicrucian pupil does two things. In the first place, he prepares in advance for the future of humanity, and secondly, he sees what will later descend into physical reality. Now you will also understand the directions which that strange man had printed, though he did not understand them. The philosopher's stone is ordinary black coal. But you have to learn the process in which you are able to process carbon using your inner powers, That is how humanity progresses. Today's coal is the model for what will one day be the most important substance for man, though it will look very different then. Do you remember the bright diamond? That, too, is merely carbon. This, then, is what Rosicrucians call preparing the philosopher's stone. Behind it lies a process of human transformation and a challenge to work on the future conditions of humanity. All who do the work are working for the human bodies of the future, for the bodies which our souls will later need. There are words which express this most beautifully, and we'll understand them when we are clear about the difference between the evolution of souls and that of races. You have all been Atlanteans once, and those Atlantean bodies of yours look very different, as I did describe it for you. The same soul, which has once been in an Atlantean body, is in your body today. But not all bodies that are like yours today have had the preparatory work done that was done by a few colonists, people who went from the west to the east at that time. Those who stayed behind, who connected with the race, in quotes, as it is put, have degenerated, while those who were advanced established new civilizations. The last stragglers in the migration to the east, the Mongols, have retained something of the Atlantean civilization. The bodies of those who will not progress and continue to evolve will grow beyond the next turn of an era and be the future Chinese people. There will be peoples, again, that fall into decadence. Today, souls are living in the bodies of the Chinese, which will need to incarnate once again in such races because they have felt too much drawn to the race. The souls which are in you today will later be incarnated in bodies that come from individuals who are today working in the way I have indicated, and who are generating the bodies of the future, just as the first Atlantean colonists did in the past. Those who really cling to the familiar, who do not want to have anything to do with the things that point to the future, will become welded to the race. There are people who want things to stay the way they have always been, who do not want to know about progress, who do not want to listen to those who take us beyond race to ever new ways and forms for humanity. This tendency has been wonderfully well preserved in mythology. There can be no better way of presenting this than in the words of one of the greatest spirits, who said, quote, "Anyone who does not disregard his father and mother, his wife and children, and his brothers and sisters cannot be my disciple," close quote. And instead showed how sad it is when a person says, quote, "I don't want to know about such a master and guide," close quote, and rejects him. There can be no clearer way of putting this than in the image of someone who rejected the master and guide and was unable to rise higher. This is the legend of Ahasver, readers aside, also known as Ahasverus, end of readers aside, the wandering Jew who sat and rejected the greatest leader, Christ Jesus, did not want to know of further development, and therefore had to stay with his race, returning to it again and again. Myths and legends like this have been given for humanity to remember forever, so that human beings may know about these things. This is how we should see this fourth level of Rosicrucian training, as something tremendously profound. And it is the way in which preparing the philosopher's stone becomes part of human evolution. The fifth is, quote, "correspondence between microcosm and macrocosm," close quote. The whole complicated human body, the way it is today, has arisen in a particular way. I have guided you through the Saturn, Sun, Moon, and Earth states. Of everything there is in your body today, only the first beginnings of your sensory apparatuses existed on Saturn, embedded in the Saturn mass, the way crystals are today embedded in rock masses. Your eye, EYE, was then like a rock crystal in the mountains. On the sun, your highest organs, all of them glands, were such that they covered the sun's surface. On the moon, the organs which make up your nervous system today were spread out over the moon's surface. The moon had a nervous system, and the individual human animals which were there did on the moon for the first time enjoy a nervous system. On Earth, human beings were given their skeletal system, for there had, of course, been no mineral system as yet on the moon. You see how marvelously the human being was made up. The eye, EYE, in us today was spread over the whole of Saturn as an eye. Having been out in the world at large, it has now become part of us. Occultists can tell you how every single organ relates to the great world out there, liver, spleen, heart, and so on, with the corresponding elements in the world outside, and what had to happen in the outside world so that they might develop. There are ways and means, known to Rosicrucians, of entering deeply into ourselves, with the sense organs our point of reference, inwardly entering into eyes, ears, and so gain clairvoyant insight into the development of these organs. I have taken you to the time in Atlantean evolution when the ether body was still so far outside that it could not connect with the point that is above the root of the nose, here in the head. We have seen how the ether body then moved into the physical body, how the physical body then assumed its present configuration. There is only one method of entering deeply, using a specific formula which is passed on by mouth. If you use this and enter deeply into the place where the head is connected with that place in the ether head of which we are talking, then insight arises for you into that time on Earth, into the way the Earth looked at that time, when this part of the ether head moved into the physical head. In this way, you can enter into every part of your microcosm, and so get to know the powers of the macrocosm, the work which the world's architects did to put you together. According to the directions given in occultism, you can therefore get to know the macrocosm, for all things in the world, out there in the macrocosm, have a corresponding organ in the microcosm. Human beings are highly complex. When you get a telegram, you can draw conclusions as to the sender from its content. When it comes to the human body, you can enter deeply into the organ to draw conclusions as to its creator. With this, we have already touched on the sixth level, known as, quote, entering deeply into the macrocosm, close quote. Having thus come to know how the microcosm relates to the macrocosm, one has extended oneself into insight into the whole world. This is what is behind the ancient words, come to know yourself. Much damage has been done by theosophists who said, quote, the whole of God, the most sublime principle, does already exist in you. You only have to look inside yourself and you'll come to know the whole world. Close quote. This turning inward and brooding is the most foolish thing you can think of. All you get to know in this way is your lower eye, something you do already have. In this way, no one learns more than he has learned already. Genuine self-knowledge is only gained in the complicated way described, and is at the same time also knowledge of the world. Genuine theosophy is not designed to make things easy for people. It has to say, quote, you must come to know even the most complicated entity there is by entering into this calmly and in all seriousness. There is no other way of coming to know the God than by coming to know him bit by bit in the world. Close quote. Patience and endurance are part of this. Advance calmly and slowly, and you'll come to know the world. Theosophy can provide no formula, no cure-all, to gain full insight. All it can do is show you the way which will take you to self-knowledge, and thus also knowledge of the world. And human beings will then also come to know God. The insight which human beings gain on the sixth level is not dry, rational understanding. It is such by nature that it brings us closely together with the world. Those who have gained it will have a close relationship with all things in the world, something people of today know only in the mysterious relationship of love between man and woman. And this is based on a mysterious insight into the nature of the other person. Such a relationship where you do not only understand but feel connected with all creation, just as the lover feels connected with his love, is gained as you behold the macrocosm. You will then have a close relationship, a kind of love relationship, to the plant, to every stone, to all life in the world. Your love for all life forms will grow specialized. They will tell you something which they will otherwise only tell you when you have not yet descended to knowledge. Animals feed on things that are good for them, leaving anything that is not. They relate in sympathy to the one and antipathy to the other. Man had to lose this direct relationship to things in order to gain his present-day knowledge, but will regain it at a higher level. How does an occultist know today that the flower of a plant has a different action in man than its root does? How does he know that the action of an ordinary root differs from that of a carrot? Because things are telling this to him again in the same way as it is with the animals. This close relationship exists at the lower levels, where the rational mind does not come into it. At the highest levels, humanity will have it in conscious awareness again. When one has come this far, the seventh level is something which arises of its own accord. You have been able to see from the above that this is a matter of gaining insight into impressions gained in the mind and feelings. There is nothing here that would not move the human heart in the liveliest way. Because of this, you must not make a distinction in this between ideal and intellectual and spiritual insight. Occultists do not seek to move you, to tell you all kinds of nice things. They tell you the facts of the spiritual world. They would think it shameless to seek to touch directly on your feelings. They know, however, that the facts, when told, speak for themselves. They themselves are there to evoke the feelings. Because of this, the person of the teacher has no significance in Rosicrucianism. The doctrine has nothing to do with the person. The teacher merely provides the opportunity for the facts to speak to people. And he'll be all the more correct the more he makes himself the means of expression for beholding the higher worlds. People who still believe and have opinions and views of their own do not make suitable occult teachers. For if feeling were to decide things and not objectivity, you may well end up saying that 2 and 2 makes 5. You see, therefore, how Rosicrucians gradually come to gain insight into the higher worlds by developing a number of things in themselves. It does need instruction, but everyone who is earnestly seeking will find this at the right time. It would be wrong to say that in being given personal instruction, one works through these 7 levels one after the other. The teacher will select whatever is most suitable for one person or another. It has also been my intention to give you the preliminary stages, Now I'll just take two things to show you that other things have to be developed before one moves on to the more serious exercises. One thing one has to practice from the beginning is concentration. Concentration in the life of thoughts. Just think how thoughts flit about in your mind from morning to night. They come from here or there and take you along with them. As a Rosicrucian pupil, you have to set aside a time when you are master of your thoughts, when you take the most uninteresting object you can think of and reflect on it. This will prove enormously beneficial for you. Time does not matter. Energy, patience, and endurance are what is needed. The other thing is positive thinking, as we call it, where we look for something in life that is best described in a Persian legend about Christ Jesus. One day when Christ Jesus was walking with his disciples, they saw a dead dog by the roadside that was already decomposed a great deal. The disciples, not being as far developed as Christ Jesus, turned away from the ugly sight. Christ Jesus stood still, looked musingly at the carcass, and said, quote, "Surely the creature has the most beautiful teeth." Close quote. Ugly as many things in the world may be, there is always something beautiful in the ugliness, a grain of truth in all untruth, something good in all things evil. People often think that one should no longer consider anything to be bad, and so on. What is meant, however, is that in anything that is ugly, there is always still a grain of beauty, and there is some good in every evil. This raises up the higher powers of the soul. All this is part of the preparation. My intention has been, first of all, to give you an idea of the spirit which reigns in Christian Gnostic training. In Rosicrucian training, you have the deepest, most genuine Christianity, and can be a Christian in the truest sense of the word, in spite of all modern life. It was possible to be a Christian in the old style for as long as there were more opportunities for withdrawing from the world, and for as long as the thought forms had not yet entered into us that make it so hard to be a Christian today. The ideas coming from the natural scientific way of thinking do make it hard for people to accept Christianity in its original form. Indeed, it is the noblest minds who say, quote, "I cannot reconcile anything today with Christianity." Close quote. The spiritual world lives all around us, but so do the thought forms produced in our materialistic age. We are always surrounded by the thought forms of material life. A conscientious person therefore has to say to himself or herself, quote, "Our age needs something which can hold its own in the midst of the ideas that come flooding in, so that we may stand tall in the face of everything that comes flooding in from the world." Close quote. Spiritual science provides it for us. We are egotists if we reject it and do not wish to make it our own. Spiritual science is like the executor for something which was the will even in medieval theosophy. It can, however, be understood by everyone, even those who know all the justifiable objections raised in natural science. Today, everyone will be able to find in theosophy, with Rosicrucian orientation, the things that guide one to insight into the world and also to peace in one's soul, to being secure in life. The theosophy of the Rosicrucian is no mere theory, something to enter into dispute about, giving mere reasons. It is an insight that must flow into the whole of our civilization. A theosophist trained the Rosicrucian way knows all the objections that may be raised. He is fully aware of all the counter-arguments. If we were to counter them using reason, things might go for us the way they once did for Edward von Hartmann with his title Philosophy of the Unconscious. Edward von Hartmann published this work. He had said things in it about Darwinism and so on that appeared to be like a more elevated point of view compared to the materialist one in scientific research. All the academics then rose against him, and a flood of criticisms appeared. Edward von Hartmann was called the worst of all amateurs. Among the many brochures was one written by an anonymous author. It was a brilliant refutation of titled The Philosophy of the Unconscious, giving consideration to everything someone would know about who masters the knowledge of our time. This brochure was much praised by everyone. Oscar Schmidt, the great zoologist, said, for instance, quote, "What a pity that we don't know who has written this rejoinder, for that is someone who is at the very summit of present-day natural science." Close quote. Ernst Haeckel said, quote, "Let him give his name, and we'll have him in our ranks." Close quote. The brochure did indeed make a great impact. A second edition then appeared bearing the author's name, Edward von Hartmann. Now the scientists fell silent, and the story has not come to be widely known, but it did indeed happen. You see how, when one has gained a higher point of view, one can oneself mention all that speaks against it. One only has to get oneself down to a different point of view. If there had been enough time, we too could have gone into some such counter-arguments. But it was important, time being short, that we were able to learn what can already be said today about the realities of the higher worlds. What matters is that these things can benefit people, and that one is able to show how spiritual science can enter more and more into all the branches of human life and make them fruitful. And when it is able to do so, then the very fact will be the best proof of its justification. This should be the kind of proof we look for in spiritual science. A theosophist won't be greatly shocked, therefore, when people are still saying today that it is all mere fantasy. Everything which has gone on to be a blessing for humankind has always been called fantasy at first. An example from the 1840s. Stamps, as we know them, did not exist at that time. They were only introduced by someone called Hill, an absolute amateur, really. The member of Parliament asked to present the idea gave a most peculiar speech. Quote, "In the first place," he said, "it cannot be that traffic increases to the extent which this man has calculated, and if that were the case, one would have to increase the size of the building." Close quote. Nowadays, it appears perfectly normal to enlarge the building if traffic increases. But that is how the idea was put down at that time. When the first railway was to be built, the medical experts in Bavaria were consulted, and those gentlemen said that one should not build a railway, for it would have the worst possible consequences for the passengers. But if they were going to build a railway, then they must put a tall wooden hoarding around it, so that others would not suffer concussion from it. Everything was considered fantasy when it came up for the first time. However, if spiritual science is to be a fact of life, it will have to penetrate directly into our everyday world. It will be a power that lends wings to the whole of our life, entering into our most ordinary activities. Then and only then will it have shown itself to be fact. Rosicrucian theosophy takes this as its starting point, and I would ask all of you to take this standpoint with regard to everything said in these lectures. In future, it will be able to develop into something that influences human creative powers, giving people new impulses in the fields of medicine and education, in art and academic knowledge. And this will bring soul and life to all branches of life. Lectures like these are given from this point of view, and I would ask you to accept them from this point of view. The end of Lecture 14, and the end of the first cycle in the book True Knowledge of the Christ, and this cycle was entitled Theosophy and Rosicrucianism.